Although he's been all but forgotten in the annals of history, the 17th century Jesuit priest and polymath Athanasius Kircher was a highly influential thinker, which may come as a surprise because he got so much wrong. His areas of interest covered mathematics, music, the occult sciences, geology, linguistics, optics, biology, astronomy, and even science fiction, and his theories ran the gamut from secret knots of magnetic influence to universal sperm. But he also got some things right, and a few of his theories actually helped contribute to the development of modern arts and sciences. John Glassy, a former contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine, was here in December to talk about his book called A Man of Misconceptions, The Life of an Eccentric in an Age of Change. It was a fun conversation. We thought we would air it for you again today. I began by asking, so why have we heard so little about Athanasius Kircher, a man you call one of history's colossal crackpots?
Well, I also say he's probably something of a genius as well.
And major thinkers were really influenced by him.
Well, they were. Not always in ways that he intended. There has been an interest, sort of a resurgence of interest in him during the last 20 or 30 years among historians and academics. I was really fascinated by him and felt, you know, there needed to be a general interest book about this fellow.
So who were the thinkers who were influenced by him? He came in contact with an awful lot of the greats of his time, didn't he?
Well, he did. You can sort of go down the list. I mean, even in the arts, he ended up collaborating with Bernini in Rome on two of his most recognizable public sculptures, the Fountain of the Four Rivers and the Piazza Navona in Rome there, and also the obelisk that rests on the back of an elephant in the Piazza della Minerva. He worked with Bernini on those.
He influenced Bach?
Well, yes. I mean, he wrote 30 books on as many subjects, really. And one of those was music. And his articulation of the doctrine of the affections apparently was when it's translated into German, it was sort of the standard work on music. And I think that had a great influence on Bach, yes.
Didn't René Descartes call him a charlatan and then try to replicate one of his experiments?
He did, indeed. He thought it was absurd that that a sunflower seed could possibly drive a clock, and yet he didn't think it was so absurd that he wasn't willing to try it.
But actually, that's how Kircher became well known, wasn't it? He came up with this clock that was powered by a sunflower seed?
Well, it was really a parlor trick, and it was driven by – it really was a compass. It had there was a magnet inside. It was sat inside of a cork in a tub of water, and it really operated like a compass. But he could sort of set it beforehand so that it sort of relative to true north, so that it appeared that the sunflower seed, which was also embedded in the cork, was turning toward the sun.
Well, he was a Jesuit priest. I mean, why would he do that kind of thing? He did a number of things that were obviously trickery.
Yes, well, it was sort of a parlor trick, and it's unclear really what he intended people to sort of learn or take away from the sunflower seed clock, for example. The Jesuits were at that time really great sort of drivers of knowledge and science.
Well, he was actually – he couldn't have done that if he hadn't been interested in the Copernican Revolution and what Galileo had been doing.
That's right. You know, when Galileo first, came out with the Starry Messenger, I guess that was 1609 or something, the Jesuits in Rome held a reception for him. So the Jesuits and the Catholic Church, were actually not – they were not against the pursuit of knowledge and scientific inquiry and discovery. It became a little bit more complicated after that. But
well, he did, Kircher, get the support of the Vatican, didn't he? They funded him?
Absolutely. And not only the Vatican, but the Holy Roman Emperor in Vienna He was, you know, funded by many, you know, sort of members of the nobility. One of his friends from his time on Malta, he spent a couple of years on Malta, sort of the confessor to a young, a callow German prince who had converted from Protestantism to Catholicism. And he was on Malta, and he met this Catholic official there, Fabio Schigi, who, you know, 20-some years later became Alexander, Pope Alexander VII.
Hmm. Well, and he, as you said, he also served as the official mathematician for the Holy Roman Emperor Ferdinand II. He followed Johannes Kepler, another Jesuit priest, into that. But he had a colorful youth. He escaped the clutches of a man who was called the insane bishop. Now, how much can we trust, if we can't always trust him as an inventor, how much can we trust him as a person who is telling his story?
Well, we can't entirely, I would say that. I was able to get a copy of his autobiography written late in life. It's not a full book-length autobiography, but it's fairly significant. And it's it reads almost like sort of Huckleberry Finn in a way. You know, he was born in 1602 in what is now Germany, and was kind of
on the cusp of the scientific revolution.
Exactly, and also on the eve of a witch hunt in his own town. And he kind of, you know, he got sort of thrown around by the turmoil of the 30 Years' War, and the insane bishop that was Christian of Brunswick, a general. Protestant general sort of at the beginning of the 30 Years' War and had to flee from him, had many sort of adventures kind of getting knocked around by the time of war.
My guest is John Glassie, G-L-A-S-S-I-E. He's written a book called A Man of Misconceptions, The Life of an Eccentric in an Age of Chance. Interestingly, the portrait of this man, Athanasius Kircher, is depicted upside down on front cover to give us a suggestion of what he was all about.
Yes.
Now, I want to get to some of the things that he did that actually turned out to be correct scientifically.
Sure.
But since he was a man of his time, should we be surprised that he was studying magical texts?
Well, not at all. And in fact, I mean, the book is kind of about the transition, the transformation between sort of, you know, the age of magic and mysticism and the you know, the age of science. And, you know, we now have sort of this two-word label for the period of the duration of it, you know, the period that sort of that he lived his life. You know, he lived 78 years or something like that. But, I mean, it was a more complicated than, you know, than the words, you know, scientific or illusion can sort of convey. And it was a complicated time for a lot of people. He was steeped in these notions of invisible energies and magnetic hidden influences, astral influence. You know, many people believed in these kinds of things. And I was interested in this story because it is kind of about a figure who is trying to come to terms with the changes in mindset and you know, and so on.
But some of those things actually can be connected to science. Magnetism, gravitational pull.
That's right.
Was he to some degree a precursor of Newton in thinking about gravity?
Well, I suggest that in the end, yes. I mean, what Newton proposed, you know, in terms of gravity was an invisible attractive power, which, you know, if you think about it that way, has like this kind of mystical, magical quality to
well,
it.
Well, Newton also was interested in alchemy.
That's right. And I mean, it's complicated. Kircher, by the way, came out against alchemy. I think that he may have been fooled a couple of times by some alchemists doing some parlor tricks of their own, and I think he resented it, and he came out against the notion that you could transmute, you know, base metal into gold.
Leibniz was interested in his work.
He was.
Didn't he say that no mortal had ever penetrated to the secret art of combination before Kircher? What was the combination?
Well, this is a very complex thing. It took me a while to try to get my head around. You know, it's kind of a precursor to symbolic logic. Ramon Lull, he was a 13th century kind of polymath of his own, devised, you know, this system for combining ideas, you know, in they call them volvelles, you know, these concentric circles, those disks. And it was this complicated kind of syllogistic system for determining truth. Of course, the truth that was always going to be determined was the love of God, or the truth of the one true church, that kind of thing. But the sort of system or the device was something that Kierkegaard adapted as a way of trying to understand, teach everything. You know, universal concepts combined with other universal concepts.
So he was trying to come up with a universal theory way before string theory was ever imagined.
Something like that.
He was also interested in hieroglyphics.
Well, yes, he spent many, many years in hieroglyphics trying to crack the code. The notion was, you know, that the Egyptian hieroglyphics were supposed to have encoded strands of mystical wisdom that had been passed down all the way from the time of Adam. This was a very common notion at the time, and Newton, among others, you know, worked out the chronology of peoples to try to figure out how these strands could be passed down. What were the true notions?
So Kierkegaard was trying to crack the code.
He was trying to crack that code, and he ended up publishing, you know, a 2,000-page book in which he did ultimately provide translations that were nowhere near right.
But he would have been a Renaissance. We would consider him a Renaissance man if he had gotten more things right.
Well, but he was a Renaissance man. I mean, he
was interested in everything.
And he was a very brilliant man, actually.
He also was one of the first to use a microscope to study diseases.
That's right. I mean, you know, he was certainly among the first to publish what could be seen through a microscope, and I think that was a big influence on the learned people of Europe at the time. After the plague of 1656, he examined the blood of plague victims through a microscope and saw what he called, you know, an innumerable multitude of invisible little worms, and determined from that plague was a living thing. And there's been a debate since then about whether he should be given credit for coming up with a germ theory of disease.
He also had a very influential idea of geocosm. What was that?
Well, it's kind of connected to the notion of a living Earth. At the time, it was sort of verboten to get interested to investigate geology, the notions of the interior of the Earth, and that kind of thing. He wrote an entire two-volume work in English, Underground World, in which he described his notions of how the interior of the Earth, you know, worked. It was full, according to him. It was hollow, actually. Full of ocean networks of oceans and fires leading all the way down to its core.
Well, the idea of fire in the belly of the earth is a pretty good one.
Sure.
On the other hand, he also believed in that if you danced a tarantella, that would treat the venomous bite of an Italian tarantula. Didn't the museum he curated in Rome feature a mermaid tail, speaking statues, vomiting diseases? He sounds a bit like P.T. Barnum.
Yes, he was a P.T. Barnum kind of fellow. He had this museum. It was established. They had there was a donation of a bunch of fairly straightforward antiquities there, and then he added a lot of curiosities. As you say, speaking statues and so on.
Well, you say that in some ways he reminds you of your father.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that doesn't sound too good, does it? Well, what it is that my father was an engineer and kind of a storyteller and a showman, but he had a workshop in our house for as long as I can remember, in which he came up with different inventions. He had certain patents and so forth, and he could make anything down there. He made electrical devices. He, you know, did radio devices, and could make anything down there. So I was attracted to this notion of an inventor type in a workshop, you know, coming up with new ideas and not all of them perfectly sound.
Well, you have to wonder what Kirchhoff would have done if he had grown up in the end of the 20th century and gone to Stanford.
Exactly. That's right.
We might very well be talking about him as the father of Facebook or whatever.
I think so.
John Glassy's book, A Man of Misconceptions, The Life of an Eccentric in an Age of Change, is published by Riverhead Books. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.